You're listening to a press conference from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health with Mark Lipsitch, professor of epidemiology and director of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics. This call was recorded at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday, January 5th.
Thanks, everyone. Welcome. I'm happy to just begin taking questions. I know there have been a lot of questions about the new variant and about vaccine distribution and about the single versus multiple doses. So I'm happy to talk about any of those topics or to discuss others. I think I'll just go straight to letting people ask.
Great. First question.
Good morning, Dr. Lipsitch. I'm writing a story about requiring travelers to have proof of a COVID-19 vaccine as part of their passport. And at least one country has announced that they will be using that vaccine proof to replace testing requirements. But I'm wondering, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, is that premature given the uncertainty about whether the vaccine can prevent transmission? So somebody could be infected but asymptomatic?
Yeah, I think that doesn't make a lot of sense to me as a policy. For the exact reason you say, I think there is modest evidence about some of the vaccines that they have some impact on infection and transmission, but how much is unclear, and it's certainly not completely protective. So testing would be more meaningful than a vaccine at this point.
Okay. So they should keep the testing and also quarantine requirements, or just the testing?
I think for the moment, the evidence is so limited about the vaccines, and as it becomes more available, it will be a little about this vaccine and a little about that vaccine, and it'll be quite hard to really standardize. So at the moment, if I were dealing with migration into a country, I would, travel into a country, I would treat vaccinated people like unvaccinated people for the moment.
Okay, and just a quick follow-up to that. Do we know anything approximately about how long immunity is expected to last? I've heard everything from 3 months to a year.
I think those speculations are made because really nobody knows. And it probably will depend on the product and on how, and on the individual. People who make bigger responses at the beginning may be protected for longer. But I think at the moment, it would be shocking if it was less than 3 months for anyone. But whether it will be a year or 2 years or more than 2 years depends on a lot of things that we just don't know yet, including the evolution of the virus.
So is it fair to say at least 3 months?
I think the data from the trials will help to address that if there's another analysis of the data between the time, in the sort of month or so between when the initial analyses were done and the emergency use authorizations. That's another month of follow-up that I trust, although I'm not exactly sure of the plans, but I trust the data will be analyzed on the people in the trial during that period of time. And since the median follow-up was 2 months for the emergency use authorization purposes, it should be 3 months for at least half the participants in the, if we add an extra month or so. So I think we should be able to confirm that pretty soon. I'm not sure what the companies are doing in terms of their trials, and I know they're unblinding as we speak, but there should be data in that interim period, which would confirm what everyone would expect, which is that it's at least 3 months.
Thank you.
Next question.
Hi, thanks for doing this. So according to the CDC, about 15 million doses of the various COVID vaccines have been distributed, but only about 4.5 million have been administered to people. What is your sense of what the problem seems to be, and do you have any idea of how the process can be improved?
That is a very good question, and I don't have much information. It's something I'm trying to learn more about, but I don't have much information beyond what I read. I mean, the numbers are never going to be equal because, especially with a growing amount of vaccine each day, it does take a few days at least to get vaccine from the delivery into someone's arm. So it's never going to be 100% of the doses administered. There'll always be some lead, but a third of them or so is not great. So I don't have anything specific to add on why it's been slow. I'm trying to learn more myself. I do think that one of the issues that it raises is a question of how fast we should start as a state or as a country trying to move through the priority groups. So there, each state has its list of ordering for who should get the vaccine. And my suggestion would be to move relatively quickly through that list. Not that people at the top of the list would be unable to get it, but that they would share their priority with a growing number of people over time. In order to make sure that it's not a demand problem. I think that's not the only or maybe even the major reason for the relatively slow rollout, but I think that would be one part of a solution. Mm-hmm. And it would, yeah.
And then I know you mentioned the new variant of COVID-19. Can you talk about that and does that add any kind of new sense of urgency for getting people vaccinated?
Yeah, I think that the new variant is a really big deal. I think that its rapid spread in the UK, referring to that variant, not the South African variant, which seems to be less widespread. The fact that it's now in something like 36 countries, I haven't seen the number from today, but it was almost that as of a couple days ago. And that, you know, we have a very primitive system for surveillance in this country. Means that it's probably more widespread than we think. So I think it's a very important time to, it's a very important challenge to our ability to control this virus, because if indeed it is something like 50% more transmissible, that increases the herd immunity threshold. That means that you know, as in the UK, places that were able to control spread with a certain level of interventions, relatively intense in the UK, were not able to control the spread of the new virus. If that's repeated, and I think there is good reason to expect it will be repeated elsewhere, that just makes this a much harder problem. And it emphasizes the need for as rapid as possible vaccination. And it also, in my view, means that we should focus our control efforts very much on that variant. I've talked about the limitations in the past of contact tracing tests and isolation of contacts and the like, which have been more successful some places and a lot less successful in most of the US. But one of the reasons it's been a challenge to do good contact tracing is that we have so many cases. And at the moment, we don't have so many cases probably of this new variant. So to the extent that we can find those and preferentially stop the spread, it won't be perfect. It will be far from perfect, but anything we can do to delay the spread of this new variant virus will make control easier and will help us in the race to get more people vaccinated before this becomes more common.
Thank you.
Next question. Hi.
Yes, sorry about that. I had to unmute myself. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. I did want to ask about something you mentioned earlier, which is the various dosing proposals that have been out there. The FDA did sort of weigh in on them yesterday, but in particular, the idea that one dose would be a better option and twice as many people could be vaccinated if we only gave just the one dose. Also, the idea of maybe just delaying the second dosage until more people are vaccinated up front. And lastly, the half dosing. Can you just weigh in on what we know about, would any of those ideas be helpful? Do we have the data to understand if they would, what would the efficacy would be if we were to do any of those ideas? Just what your thoughts would be. And then also, I guess, your thoughts on what the FDA had to say about that yesterday.
Sure. I think there's sort of there are a lot of ways of describing the sort of one dose or delayed second dose or even a variant of it, I think is what I suggested of moving more quickly through the priority groups, because that's a way of getting more first doses out with the possible, if very successful, might mean that some of the second doses would be delayed. They're all variants of one approach. I think I don't know anyone who's supporting the idea that we should have one dose and then leave it at that for good. I think everybody that I know of agrees that a second dose at some point is important. Those three variants, I think, are sort of one idea, and then a second idea is half doses. I'm unaware of any data on the efficacy of half doses, and I don't understand the interest in that, given that the logistics are just as bad as the logistics, if not worse, than the logistics of doing what we're doing. And there's really no data to support that. I think on the other collection of ideas of somehow delaying or speeding first doses and delaying second doses collectively, there is data from both Moderna and Pfizer showing that in the weeks after the first dose and before the second dose, there is a big decline in cases in the vaccinated people compared to the controls. Because those trials relatively tightly regulated when people got the second dose, I think in Pfizer it was, I might be getting this wrong, but it was, I think, out to 6 weeks maximum in Pfizer and maybe even more tightly in Moderna, if I remember right. I was just looking this up, but I might have misremembered. So there's not a lot of variation in when people got their vaccines. So we don't know a lot about how long a first dose will provide protection. But to the extent that there is data, it is suggestive that the first dose does provide considerable protection. The numbers are different in the two trials. They're both less than 95%, but also well above 50%. So I think there's a strong case to be made for, as I said, at least accelerating the move through the priority groups and trying to get more people their first vaccine with a very clear intention to get them second vaccines. I think the biggest objection or the biggest downside to that approach, because every approach has downsides, is that it will be hard to get some people back for their second dose, especially if that appointment can't be made in 4 weeks, but it has to be made in, say, 6 or 8 or 12 weeks. I think on biological grounds, there's no reason to believe that a longer interval would make the second dose worse. It might even make it better. There's some evidence for that in the AstraZeneca trial, although that's a different type of vaccine. But immunologically speaking, and I've asked a lot of immunologists that because I'm not an immunologist, but I think everyone agrees that the second dose should boost just as well, if not better, if given further out. So I think in the long run, it's a perfectly acceptable strategy. And it's really a question of logistics. The other line of concern that's been raised by a number of people and very thoughtful people is the notion that having single dose of vaccine would be a reason, would tend to select for vaccine resistant mutants. I don't buy that argument. I think there is, I'm actually writing something about this right now with some colleagues. I just don't see any evidence that a single dose of vaccine is the ideal environment in which to select resistant strains. I think it might be that no doses of vaccines are the ideal environment in which to select resistant strains because people are unprotected and have a lot of virus replication, and then they develop an antibody response. So I think it's an interesting theoretical possibility, but I think it's completely speculative right now, and that the opposite speculation is equally plausible. So I think, to me, that's a non-argument, but it is something that a number of sensible people have raised.
Thank you.
Next question.
Muted. There I am. Okay. Hi. Thank you for doing this. I caught you early saying some of the trials are already being unblinded, and I wondered if you could tell us what you know about that and how big a problem that is. Don't we need all the data we can get going forward?
Yeah. Pfizer sent out emails. My mother-in-law's in the Pfizer trial, so I have an inside source. I mean, not very inside. And she was unblinded, I don't know, a few days ago. I think I've seen also news reports and even maybe some release from Pfizer saying that they were in the process of unblinding. I had written with two bioethics colleagues a piece in JAMA arguing that that the process should be extended as much as possible, meaning that it would be unethical to deny someone who is otherwise getting the vaccine the chance to get the vaccine. So if you're in the trial, that shouldn't be a disadvantage, but that the process should be that people who are in priority groups that are getting vaccinated in their own state should be unblinded or should be offered unblinding, but that those not in those priority groups should be kept in the study, and that those who are unblinded should be vaccinated within the study so that they can be checked, so that they could be followed and more data gathered. It seemed like that might be the policy that was being adopted a couple of weeks ago. And in fact, I thought it had been adopted, but then Pfizer changed its mind. And I don't understand all the regulatory ins and outs of how they get to decide these things and who gets to tell them yes or no, but whatever that is, it turns out that they are beginning to unblind everybody, as far as I can tell. Understand.
Although, okay. Can I ask one quick follow-up, which is, yeah. Some people have mentioned something called phase four trials or post-licensure testing, and I wondered what the company should be doing in that regard, especially with healthcare workers, and whether the healthcare workers maybe should be tested with an antibody test or a PCR test beforehand so that they can be tracked better, so we can really understand how these vaccines are working in them.
Yeah. So another piece that I wrote at the beginning of all this, maybe in March or so, with Rebecca Kahn and Michael Minna in Nature Medicine, argued for the value of antibody testing at the beginning of almost every kind of trial related to prophylaxis or treatment of this, well, especially prevention of this virus. So yes, I completely agree with that. And there's a lot of value to knowing people's status at the beginning. Phase four studies, mostly observational studies, will occur. In my view, one of the most important things to answer is whether, and to what degree these vaccines prevent transmission. I think it's kind of astonishing how little we know about that. And a missed opportunity, although it's hard to criticize an effort that went as quickly and as successfully as the trial effort did. But one big hole in that effort is the lack of data on transmission. So there are studies being thought about and discussed, and as far as I know, none that have started on really trying to understand the impact on infection and transmission. And then there will also be a need for phase four studies on things like the duration of protection and whether it wanes to some extent and how fast and on some other kinds of questions. But I think to me, the infection and transmission question is arguably the most important one.
Thank you.
Next question.
Hello, thank you for taking my question. So the Moderna study published last week states that there were 39 asymptomatic cases in the placebo group and 15 asymptomatic cases in the mRNA-1273 group. Is this data sufficient to believe that vaccinated people will be less contagious? And is this an important factor for politicians to weigh right now as they plan mass vaccination campaigns? Thank you.
I think that result is some of the very limited data that we have. And it's good that they did that. And I believe they will be doing that again when they unblind their participants, that they will test them for asymptomatic infection. So we will get a little bit more data if they do that. It's very hard to interpret for a number of reasons. One is that the people getting their second dose who were carrying the virus could have been infected before the first dose kicked in because people shed for a long time, especially by PCR, which is quite sensitive. So it might underestimate the impact of the first dose. Moreover, the second dose is probably adds to your protection compared to the first dose. So perhaps that 15 to 39 is a lower bound on the impact on contagiousness. On the flip side, we don't know the duration of that effect. We don't know the degree to which the vaccine changes the amount of virus you shed as opposed to yes, no shedding. So there are a lot of questions, but I think it would be safe to conclude from that very limited finding that the mRNA vaccine from Moderna has some effect on infection and therefore probably on transmission, but it's a pretty small data set to hang your hat on and it doesn't answer all the questions. And it also shows that, I mean, apart from those two caveats that I mentioned, it shows that it's not perfect, right? It shows that there's a reduction, but not an abolition of carriage.
Are you all set?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Next question.
Hey, I have a somewhat simple question. So, you know, when we're talking about the new variant, I've heard people say it's 50% more transmissible. I know there's not an exact number on that, but you had mentioned that figure too. And I just wanna be helpful in like walking through people like what that figure means. So like to you, when you hear like a new variant is circulating that's 50% more transmissible, like what do you want people to know about that? What's the consequences of that? Is there like some like kind of simple math to walk through, or a kind of simple, or could you imagine like a simple visualization? I'm just basically wondering like, how can I make that kind of mathy figure feel a little more real?
Yeah. It's a good question. I think, so just to put some more numbers on it, there were different estimates of the basic reproduction number for the original SARS-CoV-2. One of the popular numbers is 3. I think it's probably quite variable across settings, and that the sort of consensus around 2.5 or 3 was premature. But putting that aside, suppose it was 3, and if that's the case, what we've succeeded in doing in some places through a combination of social distancing and stay at home and masks and also probably some seasonal effects in the summer was to get that number down from 3 to 1, meaning that the average person was infecting 1 or even fewer than 1 new patients. And that's why the curve flattened out and then even went down in some places. Those same restrictions that got us to say to 1, which is about where it was in the UK for the old variant, are going to allow it to be 1.5 for the new variant. And that's sort of how the inference was made in the UK, that it was 50% more. And so that means that we need to cut our contacts down by another third compared to the already strong restrictions in order to get back to the same place where we were. So it's a 50% increase, but to go back down is a 33% decrease, because it's a 0.5 over 1.5. So it's a big deal for a world that's already stretched trying to keep it control the old variant.
Is there something also to say about like how more quickly new cases can accelerate, or like new cases or something like that? Or
yeah, so I mean the math is something like that. If each case is making 1.5 new cases in the serial interval of the standard number is 6.5 days, so say a week, then in less than 2 weeks you get twice the number of cases, and in a month or so you have 4 or 5 times as many cases. But there's a lot of that's very approximate, and it seems like it might be a little bit faster than that. So it really is if we don't change our control measures, it really is once it becomes common, it will accelerate transmission considerably. The two things that will push in the other direction are and if we can delay it enough, the warmer weather and reduced indoor contacts in, say, April and May. But I think by then it's likely to be quite common in the United States.
Are you all set?
If I could just do one more quick follow-up on that. So like, you know, people hearing that, like, what would you want, like, an average person's takeaway from, oh, there's a new variant that's potentially 50% more transmissible? Like, what should any individual take away from that?
If you are identified with that new variant, then your isolation and quarantine and contact tracing is considerably more important even than it was before. So you're doing more for the world, for your people you care about by isolating yourself and cooperating with contact tracers than even before. And that, unfortunately, I think this just is going to mean we're in the hole for a longer time with the need for control measures, because we need that much more vaccination before it's under control.
Thank you.
Great. I have some questions kind of going along with the variant. Whether the vaccines are as effective against this new variant, well, both variants, both the UK and the South African variant.
I think everything I've seen suggests we think so. I think there's no evidence yet that there is any difference, but people are continuing to look at it.
Great. And she said until the 3/4 of the Greek population gets the vaccine, what measures should be taken both from the already vaccinated people and also those who are awaiting vaccines? So more testing, masks, social distancing, teleworking, that type of thing. Any particular suggestions for how the population could help this abate?
I don't know the situation in Greece particularly, but I think in much of the world, it's the same situation that even without the variant, we're having a hard time putting enough measures in place to slow the spread or to stop the spread without the vaccine. And it's going to be a combination of all those kinds of control measures with different varieties in different localities. But I think it's quite clear that much of the world is having a hard time, even with intense control measures, keeping spread limited, and that will get worse with the new variant.
Okay, great, thank you. Next question.
Hi, Mark. So my questions are about the variant. Do you have any kind of estimates as to how widespread the UK variant is here? And regarding how we should adjust our behavior in light of it, do you have specific thoughts on what people should do to modify their behavior? Should we consider, for example, closing schools?
I think it's really hard to know exactly how widespread it is. I think in the places where people have looked, my understanding is that there have been quite low rates of the S gene dropout. That's a signal for not only that variant, but when that variant is present, it causes an S gene dropout in the Thermo Fisher assay. And so far, my understanding is that it hasn't been seen to be common really anywhere in the US. But of course, that will change if it is indeed more transmissible, as everyone believes it is. And I'll take this opportunity to say that, you know, the UK has been something like, I would say, 5 years or so ahead of us in terms of genomic surveillance and really knowing the genetics of the pathogens circulating in their country. That's not Trump's fault. That's a long-term lack of investment that he didn't fix, but he certainly didn't start in new technologies for genomics that exist in universities, but just don't exist in government on the right scale in the United States. So that's a huge failing of our public health system. Hopefully this will be a wake-up call, but the UK was able to find it and know what the problem was much sooner than we because of incredible sequencing efforts that they do. In terms of what individuals should do, I mean, even now without widespread variant transmission, we're having a hard time as a country maintaining our interventions to reduce spread. So all those, I think, are still important, and we're still not really doing them in many places to an adequate degree. Closing schools. The one thing I will say is that if we're not going to close other kinds of activities, we shouldn't close schools, because schools are more important than almost anything else that we do in terms of what they produce and what they allow the rest of society to do, namely education and regular and childcare, which are their two most important functions. You know, people who are saying, let's close the schools and leave the restaurants open, that makes no sense to me. But but whether it does become necessary to close schools is not totally clear to me. I think the UK has decided that it needs to close schools. And I think we might find ourselves there in not too long, although a lot of schools are already closed, so it wouldn't be that big a difference in the United States. But I think there was some hope for getting them open, and this could potentially scuttle that.
And just a follow-up question in terms of how the variant affects vaccine distribution, going back to the, you know, the debate about dosing, at what point do you think, does a more transmissible variant make a strategy like the UK's delaying a second shot look better than Operation Warp Speed's approach of reserving a second shot for people? That is to say, with, you know, if the variant was 30% more transmissible or 70% more, how do you weigh all those together?
It's certainly one thing it does do to vaccine distribution, and we have a preprint on MedArchive that looks at this a little bit, is that as the reproduction number gets higher, so transmissibility gets higher, it becomes more advantageous to vaccinate those at high risk of complications and less advantageous instead to vaccinate those who transmit the most, because essentially the direct effect, the benefit to those vaccinated in preventing severe disease and death doesn't really depend on how contagious it is, but the transmission benefits are most striking if you are dealing with a modestly transmissible virus to begin with and become less effective when you have a more contagious virus. So in terms of who gets priority, the elderly and comorbidities approach becomes more compelling with a more transmissible strain. I haven't really thought through the single dose, but I would suspect that it also becomes more compelling.
Okay, are you all set?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Next question.
Hi, thanks so much for doing this. I'm curious, Doctor, what you think of ACIP / CDC's decision to split the priority among older Americans into the 75 plus versus the 65 plus population. And also what you think of the fact that several states, most notably Florida and Texas, have decided to go their own way and not follow the CDC recommendations? And do you see any issues surrounding the fact that we're going to have different populations eligible quicker in some states than other states?
Yeah, I think that was a close call. And my personal preference would have been to go with the dissenter, the one dissenting member of ACIP's view, which was that 65 plus should have been the priority rather than 75 plus. Clearly the risks are increasing exponentially with age, and so 75 plus are indeed at higher risk overall, but 65 plus are also at very high risk. So my personal preference would have been to for ACIP to have gone with the 65 plus. I don't know whether it's a really a problem for different states to have different policies. That's clearly going to happen in many situations. And because of the structure of how we govern vaccine prioritization, that's just inevitable. And you know, I don't agree with a lot of the policies during this pandemic from Florida and Texas, but in this particular, a good decision.
Can I just follow up on why you think it would have been better to go with the 65 plus and whether there's an issue there when it comes to availability of the vaccine? The ACIP members, some of whom even said during the meeting, they wished it was 65. They were looking at it from a practical standpoint of being able to get that volume out with the extra tens of millions of people.
Yeah, I think it comes down to a trade-off between age and essential workers, because the 65-75 group is a big group. And so it's a delay for the next priority group if you put 65-year-olds ahead. You know, there are different arguments for why to prioritize essential workers and who exactly that should be. And my simple view is that public health policy should, as a first pass, try to minimize the number of lives lost. And my perception, although again, the data are sort of shockingly limited, but from my best understanding of the data is that the most lives would be saved by getting vaccine to 65 and over relative to getting it to people of who are essential workers. But I think that's somewhat uncertain because the data are so limited, although I'm pretty sure that that's true. And also I think there is a view that other priorities besides the raw number of lives saved should be considered.
Just one
I think Barry Bloom is on this call, who's also thought a lot about this. I don't know, Barry, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you're on, do you want to add anything?
Feel free to unmute yourself, Barry, if you'd like. You should be able to.
No, I accept your answer. These are really tough trade-offs that deal with who's most likely to die and who's at greatest risk facing COVID patients every day, transmitters every day in the course of their work, which is required to keep governments and cities and society going. It's a tough trade-off. I would share personally Mark's view of getting down to 65s and sparing younger people in the essential workers group. Politically, I think that would be very difficult. They're organized, they have unions. I don't think they would like that. And I think those are the kind of difficult positions the governors are making in every state.
Thank you. Just one quick follow-up. We're seeing a kind of a backlog, if you will, or a lag in being able to get vaccines in arms. And I'm wondering if either one of you think that relying on the CVSs, the Walgreens, the other chains to do more than put them in the arms of people in nursing homes, but to open that up more to the over 65 or over 75 population would help us get these vaccines out to more people sooner.
I'm not sure. This is beyond my competence.
Okay.
Great. Next question.
Hi, Professor Lipsitch. Given this new variant and the speed with which it's transmitting, what is your sense for the prospects for the year ahead? I think a lot of people thought that we might have this under some semblance of control by midsummer?
It's certainly not good news. I think I was not one of the ones who thought we would have it under control in the literal sense of declining case numbers by midsummer, or at least I wasn't confident in that, because I think the data on how much reduction in transmission the vaccines provide is still so limited that I don't know that it's really, the vaccines are going to have that effect even with high coverage, which I'll blog post, maybe Nicole can post on from the CCDD blog. So this doesn't help. But as I mentioned earlier, one good thing about vaccines, about the vaccination of the most high risk people for severe outcomes, is that that's less, the impact is less dependent on contagiousness. So even if this is turns out to be more contagious due to the changing genetics, if someone's protected, they're protected, and we think, as I mentioned, that the vaccines will be protected against the new variant. And so my suspicion is that the way that we will get out of the crisis that we're in is not by halting transmission of this virus, but by making it, by defanging it effectively, in other words, by protecting enough of those highly vulnerable people so that even if there is transmission going on, it's not causing nearly so much destruction to human lives and to the medical system. And that, I think, wouldn't change dramatically with higher contagiousness. The ability to suppress transmission will change with higher contagiousness, but I think that was dubious, or that was only part of the solution in the first place.
Thank you.
And I was looking for the blog post you were mentioning. I cannot find it yet, but I will.
Okay, I'll see if I can find it.
You may know the website better than I. Next question.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my question. So I'd like to bring you back to a topic you mentioned earlier in this conversation. You talked that the second dose would boost just as well if given further out than the 21 or 28 day mark given by manufacturers. Can you just explain that a little more, please?
Yeah. My understanding is that the choice of the 3 to 4 weeks in the trials was made because they wanted to do the trials quicker and get an answer quicker, which was a very good reason to pick that interval. But there's nothing magical about those dates. It needs to be at least a certain length of time because you need to make the first immune response and have the immune system sort of go back somewhere to something like baseline before giving, you know, so you can't give it 10 minutes later, and you can't give it a day later, as far as I'm aware, and get a proper boost. But 3 weeks or 3 months, those kinds of changes are made all the time in vaccine regimens just for logistical reasons. For example, almost every vaccine that we give in the childhood series is given with a 2 month to 1 year interval between doses. So there's just no reason to think that the 3 to 4 weeks is optimal. It's optimal for getting people a second dose quickly, but it's not optimal for getting a good immune response. And in fact, most of the dosing intervals are you want to put in the childhood vaccination schedule, you put it in at the same visit as other vaccines so that people don't have to make multiple visits. And so that determines the dosing interval. So it's not a, it's not a clever calculation about the immune system. It's just, it's a logistical decision. Again, Barry might have something more to say on this topic.
I think it's complicated, as Mark says, because there's so many unknowns. There's a difference between an RNA vaccine, about which we know very little, other than the companies say the RNA is not self-replicating and degrades, so that the ability of the RNA to keep producing antigen would strike me as being very short-lived in individuals compared to a measles vaccine or a mumps vaccine, where you're using a live virus that persists for quite a while until you get enough antibody to neutralize it. I think on the issue of boosters do a couple things that might be relevant, particularly with mutants of virus around the spike protein. We don't know. But boosters both increase the amount of antibody. The half-life of IgG antibody is 21 days. The more you have to start with, as you every 21 days lose half, the longer you have persistent antibody above a threshold that would be required for neutralizing the virus. Once you get below that, your antibody not only is too low to be effective, but as you get to the threshold, that's a good place to select for variants, because you don't have enough antibodies around to all the potential pieces of the virus. So, and the second thing the booster does is increases the number of memory cells, both T cells and B cells, that sustain the memory of the response, so that if you get reinfected a year from now, there are cells, even if you don't have antibody in the blood, that are sufficient to make a rapid response. So preserving the booster is not trivial. And I think Mark's point is also well taken, that if you get protection for 3, 6, or 12 months from a single shot, and you put it in the right phase group, you're going to save more lives. That's another trade-off that's very difficult.
Okay, thank you so much. Because we have some of the, I'm in Florida, and we have some of that 65 and up who are getting the vaccine, but they're really concerned they're not going to make that window because getting appointments is difficult. So now I can tell them it's okay if you don't get it in that window. So thank you very much.
Next question.
Hi, I just wanted to ask how much sequencing you think we should be doing. What is the optimal amount that we should be doing, given, especially given this higher transmissibility with the new virus? Like, what percentage of virus should we be testing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there are two issues. One is, what do we do about this new variant? And the other is, how do we have a system so that we don't have a surprise like this the next time? For the new variant, a colleague and I have written a piece that's being looked at the moment at a newspaper, suggesting that we actually try to refocus our contact tracing efforts on this new variant, which would mean that when someone tests positive, we would use a screening tool like the Thermo Fisher, which doesn't tell you if it's a new variant, but can tell you that it's not, that it might be, or that it definitely isn't. About whether the strain that person has is the new variant, and if so, make extra efforts to shut down that chain of transmission. Again, imperfect, and it won't catch everything, but slowing things down is a value in itself. And in that case, we don't have to sequence everything, but we should be testing everything with a technique that tells us yes or no on the variant. A second thing that now is increasingly unimportant is to know whether it's here, because it's now clearly in many places in the US, which means that it's probably in almost every place in the US, and we just haven't seen it yet. So that gets to the question of how you set up a system. And with that, you know, the UK was sequencing thousands of isolates a month in a smaller population than ours. If you were really trying to do it on a shoestring, I think if you did 1,000 isolates every 2 weeks or so, you would, from a representative sample around the country, perhaps oversampling places where people are coming in from outside the country, you would have a pretty sensitive early detection system if you knew what you were looking for. And you would also have a set of data telling you how the virus was evolving within the United States. That would be a sort of minimal approach. There's no reason, given the how cheap the technology is and robotics and other things, why we couldn't do much more than that and have it for a lot of other viruses and really have a proper system. And that's what the UK has been building over the last 5 years or more. And we've just been very, very slow. So I think you know, when everyone has time to breathe, that should be a very high priority for setting up the public health system of the 2020s.
And I wanted to ask you about, you know, the FDA's statement on why, no, we're not doing the two doses, we're not going to give like half a dose. And they said on the two dose, the participants who didn't receive the two vaccine doses during the trial at either of those intervals were only followed for a short period of time. So they can't conclude anything definitive about the depth or duration of protection from the single dose percentages reported by the companies. Is that a function of, well, we can't proceed because we don't know what we don't know? Or, you know, what? How would you respond to that? Barry Bloom might have sort of spoken about that as well, but yeah. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I think that the FDA is a regulator. They're not in the broad sense of public health agency. Their job is to make sure that the things that we inject into ourselves and take as pills and supplements and whatever do what they are advertised as doing. And in that narrow sense, they're right. The data are only for some weeks and they are not perfect. I mean, they're not very many people. Well, it is a lot of people. It's not very many cases. It's in the tens. And we don't know how long it lasts. And so from the strictly regulatory perspective, I think they're correct. Regulatory is one piece of the puzzle, and public health is about more than sort of truth in advertising and regulation. And so I think those who take the view that we should encourage people to get first doses more rapidly and perhaps let the second dose be 6 weeks or 12 weeks later are drawing on a knowledge of biology and how other vaccines work and drawing on the sense that we have a crisis here and that that acting on limited information is what you have to do in a crisis, and that all things considered, it's a better public health action. And I think it's a really interesting case where sort of science as regulators see it and science as public health in the broader sense sees it might be sort of different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course we could also do what we do with our children, which is just assume that they're not completely protected until they have their second dose. You know, in other words, still follow the same mitigations. The only other thing I wanted to ask you was when you were talking about immunity, why is it that we don't have better data on immunity, given that we can do, you know, testing for T cells and neutralizing antibodies? And is the only way to get the length of immunity through real-time monitoring? Like, oh, it's been 6 months, so you have immunity for 6 months or 3 months? Like, is there a way to get it through better testing or through science as opposed to just watching and waiting?
Again, Barry might have thoughts on this. My simple answer is that the connection between measurements of the immune system and measurements of protection is still not well defined. So we know that, we know some things, that antibodies predict a level of immunity and that you can transfer immunity to a new person or a new laboratory animal with antibodies in many cases. So we know a lot of things, but we don't have a way of saying, of measuring a whole bunch of things in a person and saying this person is 27% protected or 84% protected or whatever. It's more imperfect than that. And so, yes, we can monitor T cells and we can monitor antibodies, but we don't have a perfect mapping from what those measurements tell us to whether the person is actually protected. And then the piece about protection against infection as opposed to disease is just another level of that same problem, that we don't know what predicts that. And the trials were done in such a way that we didn't measure that outcome very much, except in like the people coming back for their second vaccine in the Moderna trial. But more or less, that question was left for later.
Next question.
Thanks again, Dr. Lipsitch. John Shaw touched on my question a little bit, but hopefully you don't mind if I press on it a bit. By spring 2020, experts, yourself and others, were talking about what could happen come fall, winter. And I guess it's fair to say that it did. So given that you know a lot more now about all aspects of the virus and the disease and mitigation efforts, yet we've got this emerging strain, I hoped you could lift your gaze and look ahead as far as you think worthwhile for the public to hear in terms of what you expect come spring, summer, and perhaps fall, winter.
Well, I think in the next few months, we're going to be dealing with, you know, it's still winter or winterish. Vaccines are rolling out slowly. Their impact on transmission is uncertain. So I think we're in for at least the same level of impact that we've had. And in many parts of this country and the world, case numbers are continuing to go up. So that means it's getting worse, not staying the same. And the new variant, if it behaves as we imagine it will behave, is going to make things worse. I think there's some reason to hope, some basis to hope that in the summer, or the late spring and early summer, the level of vaccine coverage in the rich countries will get to the point where the healthcare system is no longer crushed, because the healthcare workers are protected and the people most likely to need the healthcare system are protected by the vaccine, and that transmission may be still quite widespread, but that the impact of that will be blunted a lot, and that it will start to allow us, along with the impact of the seasonal changes, to have something more like a normal life. I think before the new variant, I was more hopeful of a summer that would be kind of allow people to go to camp and travel and that sort of thing. I'm less sure about that now. But the vaccines, assuming no negative surprises with the vaccines, and expecting that there will probably be more vaccines approved or authorized in the coming months. You know, the vaccines really are a huge change for the better, and I think that will be our way out. But I think the news doesn't help with that.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Dr. Lipsitch has about 5 more minutes, so we'll try and get in as many questions as we can.
Hi. I heard you saying earlier that this strategy of giving just the first dose of the vaccine and spreading it to more people is acceptable, but I'm hoping that maybe you'll put a little bit of a finer point on, you know, if you were making the call, how far would you spread that first dose before you go back and give a second dose?
I don't remember saying the word acceptable. I think I'm more enthusiastic about that.
Okay.
I don't know, but so I the short answer is I'm not sure, but I think, and we're working on some studies to try to understand the impact of various policies, at least in modeling it. I think if I were making the call with what I know now, I would speed up the progress through the priority groups to be on a relatively rapid cadence, so that each state has got its own list and subdivisions and all of that, so it's a little hard to say what that should be, but that within a few weeks of opening it to one group, I would be considering opening it to the next group, depending on how finely the groups are divided. And the goal of that would be to make sure that demand is not the limiting factor for getting the vaccine out. And more than that, I can't really say, but I think I might have more to say in a few weeks.
Maybe I could just make a comment. And over 50,000 people have been tested in trials with the first two vaccines. So there's a lot of data, even as short as that period has been. Once you start saying we have data that shows that it makes sustained immune responses at high levels, 94% protection, that's what we have to work with as scientific data. Once you start speculating, if we gave it one dose and maybe we could get 6 months later people back again, maybe a year we could get them back again, although that's unlikely, and that boosters actually extend the life of immunity, that's an area where I think many scientists, and I would guess Fauci would come out in this, who has supported the current policy, that's faith-based decision-making, not evidence and data-based decision-making. It's common sense. And so one has to worry about I would say, for the integrity of the process, which is under question by many people, whether vaccines are safe, whether the government is corrupt, whether FDA knows what it's doing. There's a certain logic to saying we have good evidence for one thing, stick with it, and hopefully it will be able to be disseminated to everybody else. I agree with Mark. I don't think there's anything magic about 21 or 28 days for a booster. I don't know how long it is appropriate to hold off the booster. Amy had mentioned the recommendation of Dr. Slowey to consider, which is also not based on a huge amount of data, but if I understand it correctly, and I would urge you to check my memory, the Pfizer vaccine uses 30 micrograms of messenger RNA. The Moderna vaccine uses 100. If they both give you 94% protection, is it unreasonable? And when you look at the phase 2 trials, the antibody titers at half the dose in the Moderna phase two were absolutely the same as they were both very high relative to 100 micrograms. So that I would guess his thinking is you're approaching the maximum level of protection with half the dose of antigen. That's probably not a great extrapolation to give half the dose twice. But that's again, faith-based decision-making, not based on the data that we have in hand. And those are hard decisions that states are going to have to make, and the companies.
Sorry, I can't let that one pass. I can't accept faith-based decision making. I think there's a really big difference between, and I'm sure this is what you mean. I think this is what you mean too, between faith-based and based on our best understanding of other science and of how things work, but without precise data showing that this thing works. But faith-based has a baggage that I'm not willing to accept.
Dr. Lipsitch, I know you need to go. I will ask real quickly because Dr. Bloom is already on the call, and I don't know if there are any other questions about vaccines. If there are, Dr. Bloom, would you be interested in staying on for a little bit longer to answer those questions?
Yeah, I could stay on for 5 minutes.
You're amazing, thank you. Dr. Lipsitch, do you have any final thoughts for us before you go?
Nope, thanks. This has been, as usual, a very interesting discussion. Great questions. Thank you both all.
All right, so I'll let you drop off, and it's good seeing you again. Happy New Year, and talk to you again soon, I'm sure. All right, for those of you who are left, I don't know if you have any questions about vaccines, but if so, we'll just try and get through those as quickly as we can.
Yes, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate your extra time. The question I wanted to ask, now that vaccines are arriving, I see a lot of lay people assuming that as soon as they and their close family or friends are vaccinated, they will be able to immediately do get-togethers and trips without having to worry about social distancing or masks. Someone just told me the other day, you know, as soon as my 10 closest friends and I are vaccinated, I'm going to go on a cabin weekend with them with no social distancing. So I want to give readers a realistic picture of what to expect. And I know Fauci has said social distancing and masking should continue until around 80% of the population is vaccinated. But what about when you're in a group of people, all of whom have been vaccinated? There's confusion as to whether that still applies for many people. So I hope you can address that.
So the first premise is no vaccine is 100% protective. So if everybody has been vaccinated, and everybody has made a protective response, I can't see anything wrong with having 10 or 20 people go to a restaurant, every one of whom, including the staff, are vaccinated. But the fact is, we actually, as Mark said, are not absolutely sure that everybody who receives a vaccine develops a protective response. What we know is that most people who recover from infection are not susceptible, with rare instances of reinfection, which says we can get pretty high level immunities by infection. And the question is, can we do as well with a vaccine as natural infection? And in some cases, for example, with some of the other vaccines, with boosters, can we do as well or better than natural infection? So the answer is there is absolutely for sure uncertainty that when you get a vaccine, 100% of people will be protected. The second is they take time to work, and that varies from individual to individual. 2 weeks is a reasonable time. In the published papers, there was evidence by 14 days, the curves bent, and the people who got both either of the RNA vaccines, the curves never went up, signifying that by 2 weeks, the people in the trials had enough immunity to become protected and stay protected for the duration that they were studied. I think the sense is that without getting full two shots, people would be very wary of being assuming that everybody is going to be protected, and that it makes public health sense to wear masks and do the reasonable amount of social distancing until a larger percentage of the population and in communities that people deal with. If every university student was vaccinated, it would seem to me congregation in universities would be fine, but not necessarily everybody going to the local bars at night where nobody is vaccinated, for example. So that's the best I can do. Better to be safe than sorry.
May I ask one quick follow-up?
Sure.
I think there's the logic in some people's minds right now is, you know, we hear the 95% effectiveness figure. So some people say, all right, if 100 people get a vaccine, that's 95% effective at preventing symptomatic illness, then 5% of them may still develop symptomatic illness. A higher percentage of that may still get infected. But some people will say, oh, well, I don't care if I'm going to get infected because I've been assured, you know, it won't lead to symptoms or severe illness. What would you say to those people?
So that hinges on what Mark was talking about of transmission. So one can imagine a scenario, and I'll give you a very clear-cut case, where you are vaccinated, you develop a protective immune response, you will not get sick, you will not die. But in fact, the virus is able to grow in your nose and transmit to other people. The net public health effect of that vaccine is zero. You are still contributing in principle to transmission. How feasible is that? I'm quite optimistic these vaccines may not be perfect at reducing and protecting and sterilizing against all viruses. But I would bet if you're protected against serious infection, the virus amounts that you are able to grow in the nasopharynx is a lot lower than people who have no protective antibodies. But the classic case, for example, is polio, where children, polio is transmitted through the gut in the feces and contaminates water supplies. People have been vaccinated 10 times with polio vaccine. They are totally immune to developing poliomyelitis, and they continuously shed infectious virus and contaminated their water supplies, which is one of the reasons polio has been so difficult to get rid of. I think a respiratory infection, circulating antibodies are much tougher to get into mucosal surface. They protect against systemic infection, not so well against local infection in the nose. So we just need more data on transmission to know that if you are vaccinated, not only are you protected, but you're not a threat to anyone else. And the data are not there. Hopefully it will come out of the trial.
Thank you. Hopefully in a few weeks or a few months, we'll have more data on that. Appreciate it.
I would say a couple months unless everybody abandons the trials.
A couple months. Okay, good to know. Thank you, I appreciate it.
Next question.
Hi, Dr. Bloom. Appreciate you taking my question. I was just wondering what you make of the situation here in Florida. With the vaccine rollout, we've had seniors camping overnight to get the shot. The appointment websites and phone lines are crashing. There's a lot of frustration and confusion with this rollout. So my question is do you think states are properly prepared to administer the vaccine? What needs to be done to do this in a more orderly fashion?
So my colleagues who are commentators in this area, and I don't mean Mark, who write articles in the newspapers, are very good at saying what we should have done 6 months ago. With now, since I serve with Mark on the governor's commission in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, I really have learned a lot about how really complicated this process is once the state gets the vaccines. And there is challenges at every level. And one of those that I think is clear to every state is they don't know when the vaccines are coming, and you can't line up pharmacies in remote areas when you have 2 days notice that there's going to be vast amounts of vaccines, come and get them and deliver them to all the nursing homes in your area. So there has not been enough advanced planning, not least because there hasn't been money for the states. The CDC budget has been cut every year for the last 3 years up until this year. The amounts of state budgets that have gone to public health have gone down. And this takes people, it takes expertise, it takes informatics and databases. Everybody who gets a vaccine with these new vaccines has to fill out probably 10 to 15 minutes worth of forms so that if anything bad happens, we will know who got which batch of which vaccine. And that's taking more time than a flu vaccine where you just line people up in your local doctor's office and in 15 seconds you get the shot from the physician's assistant. Getting a trained workforce that can give the amount of vaccines that is needed, can do the reporting, can have epinephrine present in case and able to recognize an anaphylactic syndrome and an adverse effect, that's not trivial. And there hasn't been money to the states to line those up. Congress does not generally spend money on problems until after they happen. And public health is built on preventing problems from happening. And you can't do that without resources. So I think it's going to be very difficult to get states to get themselves their information systems going and personnel trained in all of that. That's for the first dose. What happens in 21 and 21 days when the over 65s or the non-facing disease essential workers are coming for their first shot and people are lined up for their second shot? Are states able to plan for that and cope with that? I have no idea, but this is a logistics challenge, a personnel challenge. And yes, there's $8 billion in the new emergency bill that was passed. How that will get to the states, when it will be distributed, and how they will get the people trained, whether it's National Guard people called up, retired physicians, graduate students, unclear, but there's a desperate need to have places and people trained to administer the vaccines and collect the data to be able to be certain the vaccines are provided appropriately, collect any immediate side effects, and follow for any long-term side effects. This is a tremendous challenge that we've never had since basically smallpox in New York City in the 1950s, where 6 million people were vaccinated in 2 weeks. It can be done, but this has got to be done with vast amounts of resources and new kinds of people brought in to carry it out.
Thank you.
Next question.
I just wanted to ask if you agree that we should be moving more quickly through the ACIP's priority groups. And I'm just curious, given all of the challenges you just laid out, why there's been so much attention on social media and the mainstream media on this as being kind of the source of a lot of distribution problems. And do you agree that this is the main problem with the vaccine distribution? Should we just kind of let anyone who wants access to a vaccine get access to a vaccine right away? And if not, how urgently should we move through these priority groups if the disparity between vaccines distributed and vaccines administered doesn't begin to decrease in the next couple weeks?
I don't think it'll be a massive decrease in the next couple of weeks because we have the second dose of vaccines for already those that have had the first dose and the need to expand to include all the people in the frontline workers, the essential workers, the people over 65. It's going to take a long time till we get to people that are in none of the risk groups and are at the younger ages with less risk and obviously not as urgent. I think the premise that all of these National Academy of Sciences, ACIP, and the state committees are working on is what are the priorities? And I could give you two extreme examples. If the priority is to prevent people from dying, then you look at who's dying, and it's people over 65 represent 40% of all deaths. So if you want to preserve life, it tells you who you have to vaccinate and get that as quickly as possible. If you want to block transmission, which I don't think anybody has recommended as the primary goal, you would do college students, 25-year-olds, high school students. They're the ones that are least able to be socially controlled and follow the rules of public health and stay in and wear masks. They're the ones who go to places that are crowded, and they're the ones likely to be contributing a lot to transmission. So the third variable that every group has concerned that is worried about this is there are two others. How do we keep civil society working? How do we have essential workers, the bus drivers, the subway drivers, the police, the firemen, the emergency workers? They're mostly not over 65, but they're facing an unknown threat every day, and we need them to do their jobs to keep society functioning. And that's why essential workers, after those at greatest risk for exposure in the hospitals, where we need to keep the hospitals going to keep not just COVID patients alive, but everybody with a heart attack, a stroke, and an automobile accident, if they came into a Los Angeles hospital, I don't know what's going to happen to people who have ordinary hospitalizable conditions. So that's the rationale to keep the medical staff that is exposed, to keep the hospitals functioning. I think there's a good rationale to keep police, firemen, and essential workers in every city and town to keep society functioning. And Mark would put in that category school teachers. If we knew we could open schools, they would be the most vulnerable group. Significant percentage are actually over 65 in the country. They would need vaccines to safely be able to teach. So there's a set of trade-offs that every one of these committees had made, balancing a priority for saving lives and a priority for keeping society going. And I want to mention one other variable that has been in everyone's thinking, which is which groups in society die at the greatest rates. And the answer is, without question, Blacks and Browns, minority people, are the most vulnerable to the disease, to hospitalization, to the tune of 3 to 5 times greater numbers in hospitals than age-matched white individuals. How do we be sure they're the most difficult groups to reach? They're the most skeptical groups. There has to be an effort, if the game is to preserve lives, to make it possible to get vaccines to that group as well. And that's in everybody's calculations. And I would just raise the question on the 75 plus versus 65 plus. In many places, there are fewer Blacks over the age of 75 that have survived that long than whites. Reducing the age to 65 levels the playing field for vulnerable groups where their life expectancy has been lower. Every one of those decisions is what the cities, the states, and the governors are trying to do. There's no easy black and white answer. And I would be grateful if the public realized, at least what I see in Massachusetts, the seriousness with which the advisory committee, the state, the governors, the public health departments are wrestling with those value, ethical, and life-saving questions with limited doses of vaccine. I'm impressed that they really care a great deal about doing the best with what we are going to have available.
Thank you.
Looks like our last question.
Hi, Barry, thanks for staying on. I was listening to the answer for this in the earlier questions, and I think maybe, hopefully, it's a simple math question. If the variant is 1.5 times more infectious and it becomes widespread, how does that change the percentage of the population that needs to be vaccinated in order to reach herd immunity?
The equation for guessing at what level requires herd immunity is 1 minus 1 over R0. So as R0 increases, the logic of the equation, assuming there are no other variables, is the more you spread it to, the more people you have to vaccinate in order to hold it at the same level. That number, of course, is essentially a theoretical number because it's affected by everything from crowding, mask wearing, closing down schools and whatever. Those numbers vary locally and over time. But the simple answer is that the higher the R0, the more people you would take. And if you notice, without saying why, Tony Fauci has gone up from 70 to 80 to 70 to 85% coverage. And I think that's exactly what he's thinking about. We are likely to see the British variant. And I would just tell you to keep your eye on a new variant in South Africa that worries me a lot more than the British variant at this point. There will be new variants and we will have to track them. And the question is to what extent the vaccines continue to work on the new variants, which in their own world are trying to escape from whatever immune responses we generate with the vaccine.
So not a precise number, but more. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
And what about the South Africa variant worries you more than the British?
So it's brand new, but there is a concern of where the mutants are. It's called 501B2. There's very little data that I can find in any publication, mostly in news reports, that would suggest, in contrast to the English one, that it may be less neutralized by antibodies from convalescent patients. That's just early days. That would not be a good thing.
Very good, thank you.
I think that may be our last question for today. Dr. Bloom, do you have any final thoughts for us before you go?
Thank you for allowing me on the call, Nicole, and thank you guys for wonderfully important questions.
This concludes the January 5th press conference.